Welcome to the Changemakers Podcast, brought to you by City Current and powered by Lipscomb and Pitts Insurance. This show shares personal stories and insight from those who are giving back and making a difference so we can learn and do the same. We cover life lessons, business advice, passion, and purpose. Now here's our host, Jeremy Park.
Welcome to the Changemakers Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Park. We're in for an artistic treat today. We have Dorothy Gunther Pugh. She is the CEO and founding artistic director for Ballet Memphis. We get to talk a lot about ballet, cultural arts in the Mid-South, but not just here in the Mid-South, all around the nation. How are you doing, Dorothy?
I'm doing great. I love being called a changemaker.
You are. You are indeed a changemaker, and not just here in the Mid-South, as I said. So let's start, because you were raised here in Memphis, and then you went away, and then you came back, and Ballet Memphis is a big part of the legacy. But give us a little bit of the backstory in terms of being raised here in Memphis.
Well, I'm a fourth generation Memphian, and my daughters and my first set of grandchildren are fifth and sixth generations. Unfortunately, they've moved away. It's always been in my blood, I guess. Home has always mattered a whole lot to me. Plus, I just feel like for a very long time, Memphis has had such a world influence on culture. And it's basically been, for the most part, from the bottom-up culture. It's not been top-down culture. And so I think a lot of times what we have done, especially in literature and in music, we've had amazing creative people who have done things that were off the grid, and they in many ways became part of the grid. And I also think that's an interesting balancing act to look at too, because I think a lot of outliers, which I think of Memphis as being in many ways, have enormous influence on culture. But oftentimes they're shy and they hide away, and sometimes other people mimic them and get credit for it. So anyway,
those are very deep philosophical angles we can go into for our city, and also for good. I like that. But so, at what age did you start getting into ballet, or just talk about just
terms of growing up? I was so little because my mother was interested in it, and my mother actually, M.A. Lightman, asked her to go do screen tests with a producer in L.A. She looked a lot like Joan Fontaine in her day, and she had a lot of the soubrette leads in what became Theater Memphis, and she did ballet, and her mom was British, and her mom was my maternal grandmother talked to me about seeing Anna Pavlova when she went to become one of the new Montessori teachers in England. She was actually accepted to Cambridge that was a long time ago. And instead of going to Cambridge, my maternal grandmother decided she wanted to go to London to learn this revolutionary new method of teaching. And it was the Montessori method. And she, and it was in the district, the theater district, where she learned a lot about it. And so she was teaching actors and actresses, children, and she found that they were very interesting. And then there was her sister was a concert pianist in England. And anyway, so
performance runs deep in your family.
Yeah, and through the women, even in generations and the kind of strata in society where they found themselves too, it was not necessarily condoned or approved. In fact, when my mother got the offer from M.A. Lightman to go to California, her dad said, "No way, you're going to secretarial school when you come home from college." And then the war was going on. And anyway, so a lot of things changed for her. But she was about to kind of, I guess, do something that...
So did she ever go to secretarial school, or did she stick with the career?
I think she did a little bit and hated it, and,
So at what age, so on your end, especially...
She did become a Navy wife, though, so she did get to travel around a lot.
Oh, there you go. So, see the world.
Yeah.
At what age did it click at an early age, like, hey, this is what I want to do with my life? Or was it one of those where you did it, but then later in life said, you know what, this is really what I want to do? So in other words, when you talk about ballet, when you talk about performing, you know, sometimes if it's in your family, you say, no, I'm doing this because my parents are making me, but I'm going to rebel against it. And then later you appreciate it. But others, you know, at an early age, you embrace it and you run with it completely. Well, which one?
It's interesting because another stream of value in our family was always, you know, we go to college. We go to college. And when I wanted to go off to what was then the new School of the Performing Arts in Winston-Salem, my mother, who had been discouraged by her dad, also discouraged me. And she said, do you want to go on tour like the Ballet Russe and be in a different boxcar every Well, she made it sound really terrible. And I went, no.
Like, gee, thanks, Mom.
Well, I loved foreign languages and I loved English literature, and I was sort of programmed to go to university. So so I had an offer from, well, I actually went off to a college in Virginia, and then I transferred to Vanderbilt. And then when I was still in college, I took an audition for Pittsburgh Ballet Theater, and I was accepted, and I wasn't going to leave. I needed to get my degree. I was almost through with college then, and so I always almost did something and then took a little bit different course. And I think it's very emblematic of, because I danced all the way through college and took classes and performed wherever I could, and but I think it was that, it's why I'm CEO/founding artistic director, because I always liked being analytical. I always liked knowledge. I always liked things like cultural history and sort of anthropological and psychological things about human beings, and I liked foreign languages, and so it was great to get those things in college.
Right.
And at the same time, I wasn't about to give up visual art, and I mean, I painted and sketched and took art classes forever, and my oldest daughter's a painter now too, and my youngest daughter is a writer and has a PhD and teaches at a liberal arts college in Oregon. And so you can see the you can see the blend all the way through the females in the family. You really can. And so
were you supportive of them when you look at, you know, your mom obviously the opportunities, but then saying, well, maybe not, in terms of, you know, her dad kind of telling her, go and get the degree or go to secretary school. How much have you pushed your
That's
children versus them pushing
it? That's an interesting question. Because I guess really I had my form of it with my, especially with my youngest daughter, because she was so versatile in languages, and she can speak Japanese and French, and she got pretty fluent in Spanish in graduate school, and she was a super high achiever academically at White Station, and I knew from her college test scores and that kind of thing that, you know, she could go into international law and make a great career, and then she ended up gravitating toward, you know, the English language, and she won poetry. She's won poetry awards and had poetry, you know, be published, and so. And then she ended up writing her college, her PhD was based on a kind of cultural history of American dance. And then she turned it into a book, and the New York Times critic for dance gave it a glowing review.
Wow.
But I remember at first when she told me this was going to be what her PhD was going to be about. It was going to be ballet history and how it indicate certain things going on in American culture. And I thought, can't she just leave the ballet and go do, you know? And then I stopped to think, oh, Dorothy, you know, I mean, this is such a wonderful thing that she's done, and she dedicated the book to me, and
wow.
You know, and so
But it's always, I think it's so hard as a parent. I mean, obviously, even in my words, you kind of hear the voice of your parents in your back of your head, you know, because you want what's best for them, but you do. You automatically gravitate to the stable career and anything, you know, in the performing arts or whatever. Because I remember telling my dad, I want to go into music and acting and this and that. And he's like, okay, that's great. And then by the time it got to that point, he's like, well, maybe you need to finish your degree. Maybe you need to do it. And so you always have that back, but it's the balancing act of catching yourself, but, you know, motivating them to follow their own dreams.
And my father used to always say to me, why don't you take some economics classes at Vanderbilt? I go, because I get to drop one area of study, and that's what I'm dropping. So I kept the science. Can you be happy for that? I had 1 year of college math. I don't ever want to know.
Well, outside of that bit of advice, what's a bit of advice that you still keep from your parents? Is there any, like, quote or bit of advice that it just kind of stays with you from your parents?
Well, I say that about my dad, but my parents never missed any dance program I was ever in. I played basketball at St. Agnes, and that was like a really high score. In fact, they finally just said, try to stay under the hoop and just put it up. Just put it up, you know. And they never, ever missed anything that I did, ever. I mean, my father was a vice president of this company, agrochemical company, and I don't know how, but if he was traveling, I guess he would miss. But I mean,
at what age did you figure out what your dad did?
At 4 o'clock, he was there in the bleachers watching me play basketball.
At what age did you figure out what your dad did? Because I mean, I had the same thing. And I thought, especially playing tennis, my dad was always there. I didn't even know he had a job until I was really like in high school, and you had to do a report on your dad and like what he did. And I was sitting there asking all these questions. I was like, wow, Dad, you're a really smart guy. Like, I never knew you knew any of this stuff or did any of this stuff. I just always assumed you were kind of like my ride to play tennis.
Well, I don't know, because my dad was an Annapolis graduate, and he was really good in math and science. He was, you know, I was probably desperately hoping I would show more interest in it. I don't know when I do have another revealing, you know, a revealing story about my ignorance. Well, because my dad was vice president of transportation for this company. That was his before they got sold to and moved the headquarters and stuff, and he didn't want to leave Memphis then. But at one point, I don't know, maybe it was just 10 years ago or less, I was up at the Bowles Institute at the University of Wisconsin in their graduate school. They have the very first arts administrative higher degree program was at the Bowles Institute in Madison. And so I was asked to come up and speak to the arts administrative students for a couple of days. And I knew the head of that program, and I had interviewed him for some work I was doing with the Mellon Foundation. And I walked in, and I was looking at the departments on the doors, and the one right next to him was transportation. And I walked in and I said, Andrew, why would someone need to spend 2 years getting a master's in transportation? And then he looked at me, and I stopped, and I went, FedEx. and he nodded his head, you know, and I said, then I thought about, well, my dad was vice president of transport. You know, it's like, duh, you know. So, and now I think about what choreographers do. And I was just on the runway in Charlotte less than a week ago, and there was a big lightning storm, and they're building a new runway. And honestly, I was watching. I was stuck on the airplane for almost 3 hours. And I was totally grateful we weren't going up because of the lightning storm. And I was watching all the airplanes. I've never seen anything like it. There were three rows of airplanes. And I thought, that person in that control tower is really, really a steely, calm human being. And they have certain incoming planes and some that are trying to exit, and they are watching what's going on in that sky, and they're not sending anyone out. But, you know, I was watching planes coming in, and once in a while a plane would go out. But I've never seen so much backup. and the shifting around, and I thought, yeah, vice president, yeah. That's why you get a master's in transportation, you know. Come on, Dorothy. No.
So talk about starting Ballet Memphis, because when you look at coming back here, and I want you to kind of talk about just getting all the groundwork laid, but, you know, it really started with only two dancers now, and mm-hmm. $75,000 budget roughly. You know, now you're in the millions and millions of dollars, brand new amazing complex.
Yeah.
So what you've been able to do with the organization has completely transformed, you know, not only ballet here in the Mid-South, but, you know, like I said, across the nation with some of the reviews and the critiques and the exposure you're getting for our city through ballet and through the performing arts. So talk about forming Ballet Memphis.
Well, in the early days, I kind of took it a year at a time. And I felt like, well, as I go, I'm learning. And one of the stories I've told before, and I'm sorry if it's you know, old hat to some of the people listening, but when I first met one of our biggest philanthropists, who's been with us the entire you know, journey, and I was a nervous wreck, you know, to meet him, because people, he was still pretty young and people didn't know much about him, and he was starting to really, you know, do some incredible generous things with Memphis and being very concerned about what the direction of the city was. And we got in his car to go out to lunch, and he said, "What would you do if I gave you $200,000 and I paused and I said, "Well, I'd have
cry.
To get most of it back because I don't know what to do with it yet. I mean, I have to learn what to do with it." And so now I can look at these people and say, "Believe me, I know what to do with this." "And where's your money? Show me your money." No.
Well, that was pretty good, though. Just honesty right up front saying, you know, I don't quite know. So that's...
And I didn't. And I wasn't going to pretend that I knew something I didn't know. That's like the cardinal rule of ignorance is, you know, show how dumb you are by acting like you know something that you really don't know, you know. And you can fool a lot of people. You can make believe that you have skills that you really don't have, and well-meaning people who don't know, you know, your field perhaps can follow along, but you still have to live with yourself in the end, you know. So it was not hard. Honestly, Jeremy, it was not hard for me to say, "Sorry, I don't know what I'd do with it." You know,
yeah, I'm saying, instead of crying for joy, you're saying, "I'm being honest, though, don't know what to do with it yet."
And he didn't give me $200,000. He gave me a lot less.
Well, but even when you came in the building, you were kind of joking that, you know, one of the girls said, "Hey, you know, you used to teach me. I took classes." And so you were teaching ballet as a piece of this.
Yes.
And you had this dream and these goals, this mission in mind. Talk about kind of that transition of going from a teacher to then building this company. And now, you know, as you say all the time, you're still involved, especially as the founding artistic director, but you also wear this business hat, you know, kind of back to the economics class. You're back to this administrative role as well, which is managing all of this.
Well, I think that I really like people a whole lot, and I find the world full of very fascinating, interesting people who know a lot of things and know a lot of things I don't know. And so it's really important to be able to know what you don't know and then identify people who can help you get to where you think your vision needs to go. And it takes a while to... I mean, I was really young when I started, and so it took a while to get... to attain that kind of consciousness about here's where we're headed, and then to learn to really learn, well, you know, I need someone, the bigger our budget is, I really do need someone who knows how to assess finance and understands how to deal with accounting. And, you know, I could always add two and two and know that I couldn't spend more than what I had. But I've learned a lot from really, really good people who work for Ballet Memphis. And so you have to know what you don't know, and then you have to humbly and with great appreciation fill those gaps. And I do, I mean, I'm one of those people who I do really like people a lot, and that's, I think that's the prerequisite for being a wonderful teacher too. And
and I like the fact too that going back even with your studies in college, that it was very diverse. And so when you talk about kind of the psychology of, you know, humans and people, you also have this ability to bring that to bear with the shows. Talk about some of the things when you look for putting on a show. What are some of the main ingredients? What are some of the main elements that to you make a successful show?
Well, I think that there has to be a thread that works through the show, and if you're doing a story, you have to have a storyline that people can follow, and absolutely being a well-read English major who loved the novel, I mean, that helps enormously. I just innately understand that. I mean, I'm probably read, you know, four or five different kinds of books a week. I mean, I love just
Are you more hard book cover, or do you like reading it online, or what's
I don't like reading it online.
You like having it in your hands.
Yeah, I'm not good. I'm not very great mechanically, and so, but I have read interesting studies that show that if you have a tactile experience with a book, it looks as though you retain more knowledge because you have other forms of sense. Mm-hmm. Helping you retain knowledge. You have the smell of the book, the cover, the type of print, the way it feels. You know, there are all kinds of other things that help inform your memory. So, you know, whether those studies are true or not, but then I love reading studies like that. You know? I mean, I really do. I read the Science Times every Tuesday and the New York Times. I read the business pages of the New York Times every morning, you know. I feel like I've been so fortunate that I was in the right place at the right time with the right mental and emotional equipment. And when I say the right place, in the right time, there is so much generosity by a number of people in this community who, even if they can't quite understand why the creative life matters, they know it somewhere enough to be inordinately generous. And I am so incredibly grateful that kind of thing has helped us manage to be the success that we've become. And our philanthropists have known from the very beginning that the community has to come together and that we can't be scared of people who are different than we are.
Right.
And the efforts that they have in support of my building what has now become the most diverse classical ballet company in America of particular size and budget or whatever. And I mean, because I think it's like 65% of this upcoming season of our dancers are non-white, and we have a good, you know, we have a diverse staff, a board of directors is pretty diverse. I mean,
but obviously that's an intentional move on your end to be able to build that. And I think that's important to state. Talk about, I do want to go back because I think this is a really neat piece that you kind of can touch on as well from your daughter's insight with her PhD and her book. But talk about why the creative arts are relevant. I mean, I think it's really important when you look at Ballet Memphis, ballet, opera. I mean, there's so many art forms that I think are misunderstood in terms of the value that they bring. But even to your point, that they can reflect society, they can reflect, you know, what's going on. And so, talk about it from your standpoint of why the creative arts, why ballet, why does it matter in society?
Well, I do think that the yearning to be better and the yearning to have a more beautiful society and a more beautiful world is probably latent in all of us. And some of us are lucky enough to have that encouraged by adults in our lives, and some of us are not that lucky. And for Ballet Memphis, I think it's incredibly important that we always remember that we are responsible not just for the lucky, but for the unlucky, and that we have to be able to be in touch with that basic human precept. And one thing I will say about many ballet companies until more recently is that they have privileged the very few men who've been in the field versus hundreds and hundreds of young ballet students who are women. And that's all part of a whole society's structure. And also, what has happened that is starting to change is that our mantra, whatever, has always been, we don't serve the ballet world. We serve the world with our talent. And so it doesn't matter. I mean, I've got such a talented senior staff, and we do not always agree on everything. But that is the one thing that holds us together more than anything else, is that we stop and remember that in our brief moments on this earth, we are happier and better people if we're serving other people with the talents that we have that have been nurtured. And that's why...
Well, that puts the purpose first.
I think
that's important.
It puts the purpose first.
Right.
And there can be different ways to navigate how to promulgate that purpose. But it always has to be at the base of of who we are, and we've always got to stay in touch with it and go back to it. And if you go astray, you got to reel yourself back or help reel other people back. And so
before we talk about the brand new beautiful building, give me maybe a couple of happy moments for you, because like I said, you've been written up in, you know, newspapers, publications all around the nation, even some of the world. What puts a smile on your face in terms of some of the achievements that you and your team have been able to realize?
Well, one is our we have someone on our faculty, Nikki Lewis, and she directs our enrichment programs and also teaches at the school. And when I was pretty young, Merle Purvis, I don't know if you okay, so Merle called me and said, I've got this little student who I think you should just take on. She needs a scholarship. And so I said, sure, we're happy to do that. And this is indicative of what I think can happen. Then Nikki ended up getting a degree with an emphasis in dance education, and she taught in the public school systems for a while. And thank you, we were able to lure her back into our fold. And she makes such a difference every day in children's lives, and she loves the children so much. And whenever I see Nikki, it makes me so happy, because she has that love and shimmering, she has a glow about her that makes me understand she really loves, she doesn't just love the art, she loves the children, and she knows that she's helping lives every time she goes out her door.
Well, that I think goes back to the purpose, is she's using ballet, she's using dance as the conduit to transform lives, to engage youth, to inspire them to follow their dreams. There's a much bigger end goal, mm-hmm. in other words.
Yeah, there is. And I mean, that's a quiet, more, you know, we don't get written about necessarily as much for that kind of thing, but we've done it for years. And then Nikki's so emblematic of touching the lives that we've touched. And I mean, our first, you know, our big performance in 2010 at the Kennedy Center, that made me very happy for Memphis too, because it was clear from the audience response and the critics' response, there were 9 major ballet companies from across America performing, and we were it. Like, we were the ones who sang the song of Memphis, and it was, you know, it was more of the underdog song. It was Roy Orbison, you know, who was the Placido Domingo of country music. And yeah, I mean, that was like a louder high point. And then Nikki, though, I get to see Nikki almost every day. Mm-hmm. And I get to see a quieter.
Well, we talk about that all the time, though, too, is the you know, many times, like Nikki is a great example, where those are kind of life changes, but they're gradual. It's every day you're mm-hmm. seeing them working in the trenches, working with the kids, building, you know, their skill sets up, inspiring. But it's not necessarily like a big moment in front of 1,000 people or 10,000 right. people are playing the Kennedy Center, performing at the Kennedy Center. So you tend to kind of gravitate toward the big moments just because there's so many people there. It's a big shining moment. But in many cases, the small micro change that happens every single day, that when you look back over yeah. 10 years, is a monumental difference in not only one person's life, but in many. That never makes the news, just because it's hard to capture in one picture
right.
this massive amount of change over like 10 years.
Yeah.
So I mean, we talk about that all the time, but I think it's so important for people to understand Nikki and her story, because that's the part that inspires them to say, hey, if she can do it, so can I.
Yeah, yeah. And I've done it for so long, Jeremy, it's hard for me sometimes when somebody asks a question like that, what are the high points? Because I feel like I've been so fortunate there have been so many high points. I mean, our last run in New York for a week at the Joyce, I guess that was 15. The critics, there was one writer in particular who said, show me a ballet company that has taken diversity or equity or something more seriously than Ballet Memphis, and you know, I'll be extraordinarily surprised. That one line made me very, very happy. It really did. Because that kind of said things about the long, quiet haul too mm-hmm. that we've been engaged in. So, yeah, I really appreciate you interviewing me, because it gives me time to stop and think how extraordinarily grateful I am.
Well, there's a grateful moment coming up soon with the, you know, you're, I don't want to say you're almost at the finish line, because you're never really at the finish line with the new building, but you have a brand new, beautiful building that really is opening up. I mean, we're recording this in July, but I mean, coming up in August is kind of the big unveiling. And so talk about the new complex and just what that means. And, you know, you've got all these different rooms and opportunities to do really amazing things that haven't been possible before.
Yeah. The whole design of the building, when we started talking about needing a different facility and needing to be in the sort of the urban renaissance that's happening in cities across America, we needed to be where people liked to walk and gather in community together and be in a place that was not built for us in our isolated vehicles, you know, with lots of walls around us. We needed to be in community, and so we wanted the building, as much as we could afford it, to reflect that. And so there's a lot of glass. There are courtyards where people are welcome to, you know, bring their cup of coffee and sit down and see what's going on in the studios. The main studio is so tall because we do this incredibly beautiful ballet of Peter Pan that flies five people up in the air. And so when we happen to be in rehearsal before we take that to the Orpheum, especially in the evenings when the lights are on in the studio, and because some of that, a good proportion of that, those high zinc panels are perforated, so you should be able to see through them, you'll be able to see the dancers in the air.
Nice.
And
there's
so,
flying people everywhere.
Yeah, and there's something about, to me, that image of soaring beyond is the thing that's so important about the ballet. It's about reminding people that we can imagine and be better than perhaps we think that we can be. You know, it's that spark of inspiration that's so incredibly important. And we have this great Spark program where we host, and we bring all kinds of speakers in and talk about different points of view and different things. And so, you know, we'll be able to do a lot of our Sparks in the new building. And there's something that's dear to my heart called the Outliers Lounge, because that's where I hope there'll be some books and there'll be comfortable seating. And that's where I hope, like, we could have a psychologist and a choreographer and a historian, you know, and some of the dancers. They might find themselves in that room discussing something. And so then their minds will expand. Then the art form will expand. Then people will be touched in an even greater capacity when they see the art form that we create, the choreography that ultimately gets created. And so I'm glad that the building's got a really open feel, because I really want people to feel welcome, mm-hmm. and to come in and ask questions and to see and to meet the artists, because they're very lovely people and they come from all over the world. And so,
well, I love the fact that you've got the kind of the glass that people can literally be walking by and see them training. Mm-hmm. And to your point, we've done quite a few different, you've been so easy to work with and so gracious in terms of allowing us to come in and see performances and rehearsals and things like that and bring people in. And to your point, every time we make it kind of a special treat to invite the dancers in and get to know them a little bit. And they come from all over and they have amazing stories and they fall in love with our city. And it's really, to me, neat to one, see them perform, but then to hear the story behind them and what inspires them to dance is, to me, just as remarkable.
But you know what it makes me think of when I hear you say that? It reminds me, I kind of want to say, well, golly, how many other businesses are doing what y'all are doing? How many people are actually saying, hey, let's get people out into the community and let's talk to different people and let's learn their stories? And to me, that's the epitome of grace in human behavior that we're talking about. And your leadership may not even ever stop to think, well, I'm going to be a graceful leader, but they are being graceful leaders by being gracious and curious leaders. Because once again, here I am sitting here doing my first podcast.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think, you know, even with Nikki, I mean, there's so much that once you get to know people, you realize, one, we have a lot of common, you know, mm-hmm. elements, common interests, common dreams. But two is it really does create a whole new relationship in the sense that once you understand where someone comes from and what their dreams are, you even just watching them dance then takes on a whole new meaning, because you can see it come through with every move they make and their gestures and their facial expressions. And so it's just, I think those are the things that kind of back to humanizing and building those relationships are really important, not only for what you do creatively, but for our city and our nation as well. So I want to touch on collaboration, because this is something that's important as well. You collaborate greatly, not only within the community, but with other nonprofits, other arts organizations. Talk about collaboration from your standpoint in terms of why that's so important for our city.
Well, again, it's sharing knowledge. If we didn't collaborate with Brooks, or we did this whole connection series where we worked with various, oh gosh, that lasted 6 years, and I thought it was going to be a one-shot deal. You know, I mean, we collaborated with chefs, we collaborated with architects, we collaborated with female writers about, you know, women's issues. I mean, we've just, we've worked with musicians from Stax. Rhodes helped us commission Kirk Whalum to do a piece that went on tour to 10 cities across America after that. I mean, it's it does so much good for all of us, because we all learn more about each other. And again, we create new work all the time. And I can't say that all the new work we create is always the best thing. But, you know, if you don't try to have conversations, then you don't have conversations, you know. And also, if you don't give people an opportunity to work on something new and to learn something in the process of creating it, and I mean seriously thinking about it, not just saying, I mean, like we did a ballet based on The Warmth of Other Suns, Edith Wilkerson book about the Great Migration out of the South, and so that was so interesting because I had to say to the choreographer, you will read this book. First, you will read this book. And it's like, well, no one else, no other artistic director tells me I got to read a book before I go, well, welcome to Memphis. You know? So then, you know, you kind of find out who you can work with and who, you know, are a little standoffish and they want to just make all their decisions and get their piece of music and do whatever they want to do. But I do find there's a whole lot more young choreographers now who are more tuned in to the world around them. Mm-hmm. And I think that they understand there's a vitality and a need for an open and generous conversation among human beings. And so that's what we do, and that's what, I mean, we should foster that kind of thing every chance we get, and it just makes us smarter, better, kinder people, I think. So,
well, that's a great transition into, we call it kind of a lightning round, but it's basically I ask whatever random questions.
I've already talked about lightning.
Yeah, that's true.
Charlotte
you have,
Airport.
That's true, yeah. These are just short answers on
okay.
your end. So I just rattle off random questions and then you just keep it short and then we kind of wrap it up at the end. But give us a recent book you've read.
The Sellout by Paul Beatty. It's a fabulous book. It is a fabulous book. It's about what kind of walls you build up and who you prevent from really being alive if you do that. It's an incredible book. It's a novel.
I'll have to check that out. That sounds mm-hmm. rather interesting. All right. What recent song or what do you like to listen to?
Oh, my gosh. I listen to French radio from Montreal. I listen to WKNO. Listen to gospel music. I listen to a lot of different things.
That's eclectic. That's good. All right. What do you like to do to relax?
Read good books.
Favorite place recently? We'll give you a kind of a window there, but to travel to. Favorite city, favorite place outside the Mid-South?
Yeah. Well, I have always loved San Francisco. I loved Paris. It's been a long time since I've gone to Paris. But right now, I just love to be around my daughters and their children. And so I'm okay just going outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, or to Portland, Oregon. But they're both very far away, and they're stretched out on opposite coasts. So.
Are you, as the mother, trying to woo them back? Any chance to get them back? Possibly.
I would be surprised because one of them loves the rural life, and she once told me she doesn't like to go out on her porch and see cars or people. So she's and she's married to a writer, and I think he likes having the quiet, a more quiet place too. And so and she's growing her organic vegetables and her organic children and her chickens and sheep and, you know, and painting and, you know.
Hey.
And then my other daughter is married to an urban planner, and so they've left San Francisco and are in Portland now, and she's teaching at Lewis and Clark. And so, we're all very close, but we're not carbon copies of one another by any means. So yeah, it just kind of depends. He does transportation, and
there's that
there
word again.
Go.
Right.
He does transportation, population density, and climate change. And so he's best off right now in cities that prioritize that. But you know, Do we need urban planners here? You betcha we do.
Yeah, we can do some recruitment for you. All right, so what do you like to do outside of taking guests to Ballet Memphis? Where do you like to take either first-timers or just guests to our city? What is there any sort of agenda?
I take them to Salisville to the museum. And I always like to take them to the beauty shop because I think the food is great. And it's so fun to sit there and say, this is where Priscilla had her bouffants. And then I like to take them. Well, now, of course, I'd like to take them to the new building site. Mm-hmm. I like to take them to see Crosstown because I think that's so interesting that that's happening. I like them to go see all the great bones downtown and the development that's happening down there. And so that's kind of what I do.
So do you stay up late? Do you like to wake up early? What's your routine? Or do you have...
I probably stay up later than I should sometimes because of reading, but I still get up sometime between 6 and 6:30, and then I make myself... I have a real hyper dog, and so I'll take her out to have her play fetch and stuff like that, and then I go in and I exercise for about an hour and a half. I just do that quietly in my living room, and I can't believe I'm telling y'all this. And then, and then I do my reading of, you know, my husband will read the CA and tell me what I really need to know that's in the CA, and I'll read the New York Times and I'll fold down the... I do the hard copy.
So you guys do like the summary for each other?
Yeah, we do summaries, and then I'll say, you need to read this, and he'll say, I'm going to send you this link, you know, and so...
That's very sweet.
Yeah, so...
Nice.
Well, we've been married. It's been 40, this summer be 45 years.
Congratulations.
Oh, Lord, that's a long time, but anyway, it's gone so fast.
Yes, life goes by so fast. Well, give us one thing that you want kind of as your legacy. What do you want your legacy to be in terms of, I mean, obviously you're building it every day still, but when you look back, you know, even in 10 years from now, what do you hope people are saying about you and your impact here?
That we have the capacity to care about other people and show it by building whatever we can that is, and I don't mean necessarily concrete building, but by building things that bring us together in loving kindness. We don't need to be... We need to create. We don't need to destroy. We need to care about one another, and we need to be kind and compassionate people. We do not need to be violent, destructive people.
Very well said. Last question is always the easiest, is how can listeners learn more about Ballet Memphis? Where would you send them? Website, media? Where do you want them to go to learn more?
www.balletmemphis.org. We're in the process of changing phone numbers and things, and so right now
just go to the website.
Yeah, I think it's best for me to just say just go to the website, and at some point our website will be down for 24 hours or 48 hours or something, so anyway,
it's all the never-ending process.
right.
Hey, but you're building every day, so creating, and you know, there's always growing pains with no matter what you do, so
yeah.
I just love everything that you've been able to accomplish and everything that you're accomplishing literally every single day, not only with the building, but I mean, when you look at Nikki and the lives that you're changing, truly, truly impressive. And you know, as you said too, you're carrying the flag for Memphis, of Memphis, all around the nation, all around the world. So what you're doing for our city, not only for the people, but for our city as a whole, we greatly appreciate. So you are a change maker. Dorothy, thank you for coming on the podcast. Greatly appreciate all you do.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Changemakers Podcast, produced by City Current and powered by Lipscomb and Pitts Insurance. To learn more about our guests and to share your stories of others leading by example, visit us online at citycurrent.com. Connect with us online using @citycurrent or follow the conversation using the hashtag Changemakers. Now, think big, start small, and act now. Be a changemaker.